The content here is for informational purposes only, should not be taken as legal, business, tax, or investment advice, or be used to evaluate any investment or security, and is not directed at any investors or potential investors in any A16Z fund. For more details, please see a16z.com/disclosures.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the A16Z podcast. I'm Sharon, an operating partner here, and every year our technical talent and people practices team organizes a network building event for our interns at portfolio companies, including a Q&A with Ben Horowitz, which I guest hosted this year. Today, we're sharing just a part of that conversation as a short snack-sized A16Z Bites episode. In this segment, we cover everything from how to know what kind of company to join early on in one's career to when to strike out on one's own. We also talked about platform shifts to anticipate and other bits of advice for those early in their tech careers. But first, we start with the moral of the story of Microsoft's acquisition of GitHub. So let's start with Microsoft announcing its intent to acquire GitHub. What do you think about this acquisition and acquisitions like this?
This one probably got the most criticism, particularly from other VCs, when we made it. It was, they way overpaid. You know, businesses like that, I'll never be worth the rational was went for the most money ever in that space, and I'll never make their money out of it. Like, it's ridiculous to put that big a check in anything. Like, what are you doing? And we would get that back from our investors, would say, hey, this is what the other VCs have been saying about the deal. And that's a good lesson for me. So when people say it's stupid, that doesn't mean you're not going to make money. And that's probably the biggest thing I got out of it. But from an industry perspective, you know, there's a couple of important things to note, I would say. One is that the cloud computing wars are starting in earnest, and there's kind of three big players, Amazon, Google, and Microsoft, and, you know, Microsoft is willing to write big checks to play. And then related to that is the importance of developers. So developers as a market was never that big before. So if you were in the tools business, the API business, the source code control management system business, any of these kinds of things that were for developers just weren't going to get that big. But that's now changed both kind of in market size and then also in strategic value, because the developers are the people who decide what cloud you're going to use. And cloud is probably the biggest business-to-business market there is. So, you know, as a market, as something to invest in or something to work on, the developer companies are all getting much, much more interesting than they've ever been. Mm-hmm. We call it around here the rise of the developer.
Mm-hmm. Let me think about which company to work at when you're first out of school. How do you think about that? What is it that you need to learn early in your career versus experiences that you'll get later?
You know, like, it's hard to tell. It depends, like, how early you're going in, right? If a company is further along, then you can kind of tell what it's doing. You see the product in the market and working and so on. Whereas the really early stage ones are hard to tell. They're hard for everybody to tell. You know, we make a lot of mistakes ourselves. But good people and good ideas tend to get more good people and good ideas on all sides, on the board, investing, you know, employees, managers. So one of the traps on career advice is when you get it, you're not getting career advice for you. You're getting career advice for the person giving you the advice, and that may not be for you. So, like, one, you got to ask yourself, okay, like, who am I asking for advice? You know, I always tell this to really young people. They'll be, oh, yeah, like, I talked to, like, my friend's uncle. It's like, oh, what does he do? Oh, he didn't have a job. And it's like, okay, well, like, if you don't want a job, listen to his advice, because he knows that formula. And, you know, that's true for a lot of things. People know what would have worked for them in retrospect, but they don't necessarily know what would work for you. So you have to take the advice like that. So just give an example is, look, Mark Zuckerberg dropped out of Harvard and started Facebook. That was good for him. But when he was an unusual kid with a very amazing idea that was already working, that doesn't mean it's the right career path for you. It wouldn't have been for me. I didn't have that good an idea. And I don't know if I was that just, like, developed as a person to go try and, like, build a company. I was 19 years old. In fact, I know I wasn't. That was when my rap career was taking off, or I was trying to get it going. Didn't succeed. You know, just make the right decision for you, knowing where you are.
I think about when I got out of college, there was really no such thing as consumer. My really
wonderful job that I thought I had made it was
consumer tech.
I was product manager of a RAID controller, which is pretty glamorous. I was pretty excited about that. So, you know, we've really reinvented ourselves over and over again. What do you think we need to do now in Silicon Valley to stay on top?
Well, I think like Silicon Valley is about invention, and that's what I like about being in the tech world. It's actually hard to keep up because it keeps changing. But if you go back to like 2009 when we started the firm, the three big things that we thought were going to be new and important were cloud computing, social networking, and mobile. And that turned out to be right. But those aren't the things now so much. Cloud computing still has some headroom. It's pretty hard to have new inventions in social networking and mobile that are as exciting as they were 10 years ago. So looking forward, what are those three going forward? And I think some of the things that we think are interesting are, for sure, AI, crypto, computational biology, engineered biology, and then the proliferation of computers as it relates to all of those. An underlying component to all the trends now is kind of the proliferation of computing, which, if you go back to the beginning, it was kind of one computer for every 100 people. You know, you'd all be on the mainframe, and I actually kind of started a little bit in that era. We had this thing, a DEC 20, when I was in college, and we were all logged into it and went really slow. But then, you know, it's kind of gotten to one-to-one where, like, everybody has a smartphone, so everybody's got a computer, and it's going to go to kind of the other way, like 1-to-100, where you've got wearable devices, your car's got lots of computers in it, Internet of Things, and all the computers in your house and so forth. So, like, with that gigantic rise in the number of computers out there, that becomes a platform for all kinds of things, from crypto to AI and so forth. So that's another big trend. And so I think all of those things will really change the face of what we now think of as the internet and mobile and Google and Amazon and Facebook.
So talking about starting a startup, lots of people have great ideas. Mm-hmm. What else does it take? Do you recommend people finding a co-founder? How much business experience do they have?
Depends on how good the idea is, you know. I think if you're very young, then you have mostly disadvantages in starting a company in that you don't have that big a network. It's going to be harder for you to hire really great people. It's going to be harder for you to raise money. But the one advantage you have is you have a little enough experience with the old world that it's easier to come up with a breakthrough idea. So if by some chance you've come through with a breakthrough idea, or like a real breakthrough that will change the world, something that like the world can't even imagine and you can't even not imagine, like if you have an idea that's that good where people just want to instantly join the company as soon as they hear it, and then you've got some working prototype on something technically hard or something like that, then yeah, that might be a compelling enough reason to start a company. You'll need that in order to build the team, in order to be tolerated for all the mistakes you'll make as CEO and all that kind of thing. But without that, you're probably better off kind of learning more and getting more experience and building a better network and understanding what a good idea looks like and all those kinds of things. There are definitely people who have done that, and that's great if you can, but that's not everybody. And you have to have the breakthrough idea. Like, you just can't want to start a company. I mean, you can want to start a company and go try it, and it's not the worst thing in the world, but it'll hurt when you fall, let me tell you. Like, it's painful. And it can set you back a bit. If you think about, like, how do you get to the idea, it's usually, we call it an earned secret. So, like, you did something in your past, and you tried to solve some hard problem, and you learned something about the world that just not a lot of other people know. It's very rare that somebody goes, just, like, whiteboards out, like, a market and goes, oh, this is a good blank space in the market, and I'll go build that company. But those almost never work. The ones that work are some kind of earned secret. So Airbnb, the rough idea doesn't actually sound that good, right? Like, okay, blow up an air mattress, stick it in your apartment, and, like, rent it out. What could possibly go wrong with that? But when you got into, like, okay, how did Brian get to that? And, you know, it started with, so his background was he was a designer. He wanted to go to a design conference. He didn't have money for a ticket. But what he realized was, oh, wow, there's all these people coming in town wanting to go to the conference, and all the hotels are booked in San Francisco. So he said, look, maybe we could, like, rent out, like, a space in the apartment for somebody wanting to come into the design conference, and then, like, I can afford a ticket. So he puts an ad up to rent out, like, he literally bought an air mattress to rent out this air mattress, and, like, 500 people answered the ad. So all of a sudden, he was like, okay, the demand for this is way different. But he didn't stop there. He said, well, I wonder why there are even hotels. He goes back and he researches hotels, and he finds out that hotels have only been around like 100 years. And before hotels, they were inns and bed and breakfast, and you'd roll into town, and there'd be like some old lady, and, you know, she'd rent out you a room at the inn. And the reason why that kind of started to lose out to Hyatt and Hilton, these guys who came in kind of at the turn of the century into the 1900s, was that you didn't know what you were going to get in that inn. Like, it could be good. It could be, like, pretty bad. The quality was super variant, and there was no way to tell. So they built these big brands, you know, which they connected to the now national media of radio and then television. And you knew that if you stayed at Hilton, you'd get, like, at least a clean room and that kind of thing. So Brian said, but with the internet, like, I could rate every room, every air mattress, every house to a finer degree than even, like, the Hilton can. So I could get everything about the inns and bed and breakfasts and everything about hotels in one product, like, that would be a good product, and I already know there's demand. So that was kind of the secret that he earned along the way. So your background matters a lot. In terms of, like, founders and co-founders and so on, I've seen all kinds of things succeed. Like, I think Facebook had, like, 5 people who say they were co-founders at one time. None of them are there except for Zuckerberg now. Some of them made money, some of them sued him. You know, like, I think he would tell you it was a bad founding model, but it's Facebook, so that worked. You know, I think Paul Graham did a Y Combinator study a while back, and he said, like, 2 is the ideal number of founders, and you could see where that would help in that it's a psychologically challenging thing to start a company. And if you have somebody, at least one person who's in the boat with you, that can help. When you get too many, then it's like you hire employee number 1, there's 5 of you, and it's just like kind of stupid. It's like, why would I join you idiots unless you make me a founder too? And then everybody's a founder. So, you know, you got to find a balance.
So you and Mark have worked together for over 20 years.
Yeah.
And you once described your relationship as Mark upsetting you almost daily.
Yeah. There has to be enough tension in the relationship that you're learning from each other, but not so much tension that you actually hate each other. And that's tricky. Like, if you're too friendly, then you never actually ask, you know, a hard question to the other one, or say, well, I don't think you're thinking about that right, or hard enough, or you're not doing that right, which is what you need to grow. You need somebody constantly on you. On the other hand, if it gets too harsh, then you can't stand each other, and then that doesn't work. So it's been a super productive relationship for us for, yeah, now 23 years now, through all kinds of ups and downs, and 3 companies.
On that note, love to open it up for questions.
You talked about what investors look for in founders, and I'm curious about a different question, which is, what is it that the good founders look for in their investors?
That's a great question. So I think the first thing and the most important lens to look through it from, which is very difficult to do at the time, and this is the same lens you want to look through hiring executives and actually everybody you hire, is you can't think of your investor of, like, how's this investor going to be if everything goes great? That's a bad way to think about it, because when everything goes great, you don't actually need it. Anybody can be okay. Like, any investor will be okay. And, you know, it's the same with executives. The real question is, when things go wrong, and they always go wrong, who's going to, one, not hide under their desk, and who's going to help me get out of this problem? Because they'll have the knowledge, they'll have the skill, they'll have the will, they'll have the courage, they'll have the character. There are VCs who are like, well, I'm going to focus all my energy on the winners. Well, the winners don't even need your help. So that's great. You know, fantastic. Who has the skills to help you? Like, who knows what they're doing? Who knows how to build a company for real? What do I do when I get stuck? Like, who's going to help me then?
What are your thoughts on the career path where, you know, you go, you plan on working at a big company for several years, gain a lot of deep experience in a field, and then, you know, hopefully you stumble on an idea and you start your own company, as opposed to this idea of, well, go as soon as you can, come up with an idea, you know, get jump to the blackboard and try to figure out something, start a company. Because I feel like that's more romanticized, that latter option.
Entrepreneurship is kind of like a mini scientific discovery. So if you look at the history of science, like, most of the big discoveries weren't looking for what they found. They were trying to solve some hard problem, and then they stumbled into something else. But unless you go, like, try and do an actual work and solve an actual thing, it's really hard to just imagine what the problem is and imagine the solution. It's much better to go try and do it. Drew Houston, he wanted to have his files with him wherever he went. And he's an engineer, so he's like, I'll just program. He's like, oh my God, the differences in operating systems and like this version of DOS I have here and my phone. And like, this is a really hard problem. And that was Dropbox. So getting into it, going hard at a problem is generally the way you get to a really good idea.
If we're building a startup, what would be the most effective or what would be the best recommendation that you have for us to reach out to investors or to talk to them about your idea?
Well, a few things. How you get to the investor is important. So if you get to the investor through somebody that they trust, that shows them something. Do you have a connect that's like real, that VC trusts? And I would try and go in that way because that's going to mean something. They're going to take you more seriously than somebody just like shooting a business plan to their email alias, because anybody can do that. That doesn't show me any entrepreneur skills. And people, oh, it's not fair. Well, like, building a company is not fucking fair. That's not what it's going to be. It's going to be unfair. It's going to be gnarly. It's going to suck at times. But you're looking for the people who can do that. So that would be the first thing. And then, you know, it helps to have shown something. Like, what do you have to show on this idea? Have you proved anything out on it? Or is it just like literally off of your head into the pitch? And so the more you can prove about, like, you can make the technology work or people will adopt it or whatever, that also kind of helps. That's kind of the thing.
Awesome.
Thank you.